Spearman versus Tom Wood Pontiac GMC. All right, proceed, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Clifford W. Shepard. I have the privilege of representing Mary Spearman, the appellant in this action. For purposes of identifying the procedural status of this, we originally won summary judgment in front of John Tinder in the Southern District of Indiana in a, what we considered a very well-reasoned, thoughtful, considerate opinion that took into consideration all the facts, the relevant law, and granted judgment in our favor. On a petition for reconsideration, to our chagrin, that judgment was reversed 180 degrees with the result that judgment was granted in favor of the car dealer, in this case, Tom Wood. It's from that decision that we now appeal. In this particular appeal, we have two issues to address. One, with reference to the form and timing of the disclosures, whether or not the court erred in holding that the bound, unlabeled pages of this retail installment contract package was in a form that Mary could keep prior to the consummation of the transaction.
I'd like to ask you this. How exactly was the document bound? Was it stapled?
Your Honor,
was it paperclip? You know, was it glued? Was it bound with plastic?
We actually saw a copy of the form used. It's prepared with a perforation across the top, and it's a professionally prepared carbonless form that's approximately 8.5 inches by 15 inches,
uh-huh.
And it's on both sides printed. And as I mentioned, it's carbonless, and it's sealed across the top with a perforation for easy tear out of the pages.
Well, see, what I'm trying to figure out was whether her discomfort over tearing out her copy was idiosyncratic or whether the binding literally made it physically difficult, for her to take her copy.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, a combination of circumstances, a confluence of various factors, led to her discomfort. First off, she did not know which, if any, of those pages in that contract would have been for her to eventually keep. They were, as we mentioned, unlabeled. Now, we know that the top would be identified probably as the original, but thereafter, we don't have any basis upon which to draw the inference that Ms. Spearman had any reason to think that the top copy, the second copy, or the last copy would have been hers.
And I guess it's your position that she didn't have any duty or obligation to ask which copy was hers. But she had an opportunity to look at it. I mean, as I understand the transaction, she wasn't told, sign this. And she had an opportunity to look at it and read it if she wanted, didn't she?
She had an opportunity to look at it and to review it.
And if she wanted to keep a copy, she could. I mean, and her copy, if she was confused about her copy, because your point is it wasn't labeled, it wasn't numbered, she didn't know what was her copy, she could have asked.
She could have asked, Your Honor, that's correct. One of the primary principles that is embodied in the TILA, though, is the congressional transition in policy from let the buyer beware to let the seller disclose. In this instance, Mrs. Spearman would absolutely be thwarted if she were to go out and want to comparison shop because she was not given the disclosures required in a form she could keep.
Is it your view that there is an affirmative duty on the part of the dealer to say, this is your copy, you may take it home, you may shop around for a better deal?
I don't contend that a creditor in this context has such an affirmative duty. However, for example, in the FDCPA context, you're not allowed to give a notice of this and then undercut, overmine, and overshadow by something else. In this particular case, the document was presented, she was asked to sign, it was then retaken by the agent of this creditor, and then, and only then, was one of the pages, we don't know which, was torn out of this carbonless contract package and then finally delivered to Mrs. Spearman for her to keep.
So if it's not what Judge Rovner suggests, the scenario, you don't think it goes that far. How far do you think it should go? What should the creditor say? If you don't go as far as Judge Rovner says, what should the creditor say?
I believe that it would call for nothing more than a compliance with Regulation Z.
Which is what? Say the words. What, just under the regulation, what do you think the creditor should say?
Actually, no words at all would be required if they manifested the intent by virtue of
just tearing it off and handing it.
This is yours, or...
Well, that's words.
And that's for yours.
That's words.
Yes. Also,
and
they could...
That's yours.
Your Honor, that's correct. The creditor, in this instance, could do like the cashiers do at innumerable stores across the nation. Tear off the receipt, thank you, have a nice day, or thank you for shopping at our store. They would not need to manifest the intent to relinquish all control over that copy as long as the words did not present an inference from being drawn that, okay, this is for me to keep. Rather, what's done, and as identified, it was only after she signed the entire four-page package that then they decided to tear out a page and hand it to her to keep. They knew how to manifest their intent to relinquish control at the conclusion of the case. However, the Truth in Lending Act and the regulation that implements it requires that relinquishment of control of the required disclosures prior to consummation of that very transaction. What they're essentially doing is making it a confirmation of what is the transaction, as opposed to, if you accept these terms, here's the deal that you will get. And because the intent of the TILA is to allow the informed use of credit in a complicated situation with credit terms especially, it's essential, it's critical.
How many times does she have to sign? Her copy, their copy, a file copy?
No, Your Honor, on the retail installment contract...
Just her copy.
It would... Well, no, Your Honor, the top copy is not her copy. We know that as a fact. The top copy is what she signs, and as I mentioned, it's a carbonless form,
uh-huh,
such that the impression of the top copy transmits through the other three copies for a facsimile,
uh-huh,
signature on those.
Uh-huh.
So they're all done essentially simultaneously with one signature.
And then what was the time gap between when she signed and she got her copy?
It was contemporaneous,
right,
in the sense of right,
right
following.
At the same time.
It, the amount of time.
She signs, he rips out, gives her her copy.
She signed, the documents were pulled back into,
mm-hmm,
the hands, actually never leaving the immediate vicinity, and
right,
then it was torn and handed over.
I am missing something, forgive me for being so obtuse, but if they handed her her copy before she signed it, then all four copies, or three copies, wouldn't be signed at the same time, right?
I'm not sure that I understand the court's question, Your Honor.
It's pretty clear.
Well, no. I think I'm missing something. She signed all the copies at once because...
A single impression created...
And what you're saying is they should have pulled out her copy before she signed.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's not a foregone conclusion that she will sign. Rather, the purpose of those disclosures is to give her a firm offer.
So then she'd have to sign twice.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. There's no requirement under TILA that the proposed buyer or prospective buyer sign her copy of the disclosure.
Oh, okay.
Only if she elects to take advantage of the offer being made, would she then sign the contract in order to comply with, amongst other things, the statute of fraud.
So she'd have an unsigned copy.
She would have an unsigned copy, and it would contain only that matter required by the Truth in Lending Act in the so-called federal block, which is the form provided by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Board. And the reason that's so important in this case, it's not like going to get a 30-inch color TV with remote control where you could say Walmart has 400, you know, that's plus tax, maybe plus delivery. In a car case, the purchase price is only the beginning. Then there's a whole list of add-on aftermarkets, the extended service contract, the rust-proofing, the fabric protection. Then you've got the Truth in Lending matter, which is, what's this credit going to cost? In order to be able to make the informed use of credit, the consumer has to be able to go to a competitor and be able to prove, we're comparing an apple to an apple when I ask, can you beat this? If the consumer simply shows up and says, well, the guy down the street will give it to me for X, it'll be, well, bring it back in writing so that we know we're comparing apples to apples and not oranges.
I don't want to use your rebuttal time up, but I do need to know whether the district court somehow cut discovery short, because you asked for an opportunity to adduce evidence on whether the violation, the alleged violations, were knowing and intentional.
We believe that we were given a fair opportunity to bring in these facts, and we believe we have a sufficiently well-developed record for this appeal to be presented without further discovery. Not every case has to be discovered to death.
All right, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Larry Barnard, and I represent the appellee, Tomwood Pontiac GMC. As counsel for the appellant stated, there are two issues in this case, one of which has not been addressed. The district court indeed entered summary judgment on two distinct grounds in this case. The first, on the grounds that Tomwood's disclosures did not violate the Truth in Lending Act. And second, that because Spearman does not contend she sustained any actual injury in this case, she is not entitled to recover statutory damage under Section 1640A of the Truth in Lending Act. In this case, Spearman does not allege that Tomwood failed to make the disclosures required by the Truth in Lending Act. Everything that was contained on that form was what was required by the Truth in Lending Act. Nor does Spearman contend that these disclosures which were contained on the retail installment contract were in the improper form. They were in the box called for by the regulations. They were in the typeface size. They were exactly what was called for by the regulations. Nor does Spearman dispute that the disclosures were made to her in writing. Clearly they were. She was handed the retail installment contract, which contained all of the disclosures and in the form in which they were to be contained, and she had an opportunity to review that. She even asked questions to the salesman about some of those disclosures prior to her signing. No, what they're really saying is this. Here is the distinction which the appellant would like this court to draw, that after handing Ms. Spearman the disclosures, after giving her a chance to review them, after having her ask questions about them, what was supposed to happen was this. They hand her form, she signs the original, and the transaction is consummated. Instead, what happens is this. She signs the original, they tear off her copy, and hand it to her. That is, as the district court found in this case, and as numerous other district courts have determined, that is really a meaningless distinction. She was given the disclosures in a writing in a form she may keep. What the plaintiff would do in this case is to impose additional requirements not found in Regulation Z, that the dealership is under some affirmative obligation to make statements to make sure that she understands that she could keep and go and that she isn't obligated until she signs under the terms of the agreement. That she not only would have to tear it out, apparently they have to, even under those circumstances, they would have to say, ma'am, now you can keep this. This is your copy that you may keep. And there's nothing in the Truth in Lending Act or the regulations which impose such a requirement. And frankly, that is, as the courts have found, a meaningless distinction between two facts. If they'd have torn off her copy before she signed instead of immediately after, she was no more able to comparison shop, and she is no more fully informed as to the credit terms than she would otherwise be. The requirements and the purposes of the Truth in Lending Act have been were complied with by Tomwood in this case. Finally, there's no evidence presented that Spearman couldn't have simply taken the entire packet with her to comparison shop. There's absolutely no evidence presented in this case that she was precluded from doing so by Tomwood. So under the facts of this case, Tomwood complied with the requirements of Regulation Z and the Truth in Lending Act in providing Ms. Spearman with the required disclosures in a form she could keep before consummation of the transaction. In addition to concluding that there had been no Truth in Lending Act violation in this case, the district court also concluded that under this court's opinion in Brown versus Payday Check Advance, Inc., that Ms. Spearman was not entitled to recover statutory damages even if she could prove a violation of the act. We believe the Brown case is clearly governed the facts of this case, where in Brown this court held that only violations listed in the particular violations of Section 1638 listed in Section 1640A support a claim of statutory damages. The claim asserted in this case under Section 1638B is not included in that list. Clearly under Brown, the plaintiff would not be entitled to recover any statutory damages even if it was concluded that a violation of the Truth in Lending Act existed in this case. For these reasons, Your Honor, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court in its entirety.
Thank you, counsel. You got 1 minute, sir.
I've spent more than enough time on the issue of the liability. On the issue of damages, we think that the normal principles of statutory construction provide the roadmap for the determination that the list of exceptions for the general broad availability of damages language of 1640A2A, makes it very clear that we're not talking about disclosure violation, but rather a failure to give the disclosures required prior to the consummation of the transaction. We believe that the facts demonstrate the court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of Tom Wood, and even if it didn't, that a genuine issue of material fact would exist, which demonstrates the requirement of having a jury make this determination. For those reasons, we ask for the relief of a order of remand and reversal of summary judgment in favor of Mary Spearman. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will proceed to case.